Good afternoon, Mr. Coffey, Mr. McDonald. A few preliminary logistic matters I wanted to note that, as you can see, Justice Pickering is in our remote office in the, actually, the Clark County court floor. Because due to the expansion with the Court of Appeals and various other matters, our courtroom is being used down south today. And so, as I said earlier, Justice Pickering has taken one for the team, and she is sitting in a conference room. Her ability to participate is as if she were in the courtroom or as if she were here with us, of course. But I do want to caution you, there can be a second or two delay in the transmission of the audio. And so if you are speaking to Justice Pickering or answering a question of that of hers, it may take a moment before that actually transmits between the two venues. So with that, I will call the case of Newell versus the State of Nevada, 66552. Are the parties ready to proceed? Very well. Mr. Coffey. And do you wish to reserve time for rebuttal?
If I could reserve 4 minutes.
Very well.
Good afternoon, Justice Seda, Justice Pickering, Justice Gibbons. I'm here today on behalf of the appellant, Patrick Newell, a 64-year-old man who went to get gas at a Circle K when his life spun out of control. Mr. Newell ended up setting somebody on fire, and there was a video in this case that was drastic, I will concede, of him setting somebody on fire. But to understand the background of the case and what the real issue is here, you have to understand what happened before he was driven to that point. For 15 minutes, he went into the 7-Eleven, or the Circle K. He left the Circle K, and there was a man who was reaching inside his truck. The man was drunk. The man was belligerent. It's Mr. Barano, the man that was set on fire. He asked the man to leave his truck alone. The man refused. He said, "Can you give me a ride?" Mr. Newell said, "No, I can't." And he asked again, "Give me a ride." And Mr. Newell said, "I can't." He told a small fib. He said, "It's a company truck." It was his company. But he said, "The boss won't let me give you a ride. I can't give you a ride." And Mr. Barano says, "Homie, you're going to give me a ride." Mr. Newell says, "No." He is between a gas pump and his truck, and Mr. Barano refuses to leave the truck alone. He keeps grabbing onto the side of the truck when Mr. Newell tries to get in the truck to leave, and Mr. Newell would circle around the back of his truck, and Mr. Barano would let go of the truck, fold his arms, and look at Mr. Newell, and when Mr. Newell went back to pumping gas, again, he was grabbing onto the truck and interfering with the truck. It got so bad, this younger man, this drunken man, posed such a concern to Mr. Newell that Mr. Newell goes inside the 7-Eleven, or the Circle K, I apologize, inside the Circle K, and says, "Call 911. It wasn't as big a concern for the clerk inside the Circle K as it was for Mr. Newell, and it takes minutes for 911 to get called. In fact, one of the most disturbing things about this case is the fact that there are people coming in and out of the Circle K, and nobody is helping Mr. Newell. The clerk on 911 describes Mr. Barano, the man that set on fire, as being psychotic. He appears psychotic. He's interfering with the customers. He's trying to start a fight with customers. Mr. Newell does everything he can to try to get away from the situation. He brandishes a small penknife that's attached to a keychain at Mr. Barano and says, "Leave me alone." That doesn't do any good. Eventually, Mr. Barano approaches around the side of Mr. Newell's car, and Mr. Newell pushes Mr. Barano down. Now, brandishing the penknife and pushing Mr. Barano down are things that the state conceded during trial were justified. He wasn't charged with any of that. That's how out of control the situation was. He pulls the gas pump, and he is pinned, essentially the door's open to his truck, and he is pinned between the pump, the door, and his truck. And he sprays Mr. Barano. Mr. Barano backs up and says, "It's a shirt that my wife got me." And people are yelling at him to leave, and he doesn't leave. He approaches into this small space again. Mr. Newell sprays him a second time. It looks like there may be a fight. It looks like the fight may be on, and Mr. Newell produces a lighter and threatens, says, "Please just go away. The police are coming. The police are coming. I won't even tell them which direction you went. Just go away." Mr. Barano won't go away. He pulls out a lighter, flicks it, and on the third flick, Mr. Barano is engulfed in flames. At trial, the defense was fairly simple. It was that Mr. Barano was attempting to coerce, through his actions, Mr. Newell into giving him a ride. And anybody that's ever been cornered by somebody, we're not talking about aggressive panhandling. We're talking about somebody that's cornered that for 15 minutes refuses to get away, who interferes with Mr. Newell's ability to use his truck, to leave, who, despite giving every opportunity to leave, will not go, continues to demand a ride. The position at trial was that this was a coercion, felony coercion, that there was a threat of force by Barano's actions, and that that justified the use of deadly force. Unfortunately, we were not allowed to argue this to the jury. There was instruction given, instruction 37, but the court put on some shackles to instruction 37 that gutted our defense. Specifically, NRS 201-60 says that the use of deadly force is acceptable in the prevention of a felony to a person. It's a point that was recognized in the Davis decision not too long ago, or a point that was at least floated out by this court in the Davis decision not too long ago, that the statute makes no distinction about what sort of felony can be defended against. But the court, in reading the instructions, was tended to, you know, I think there's a problem with it. We've got this Waddell case that talks about fleeing felons. And because of Waddell, I think there should be additional restrictions. And the restrictions that were put on the defense over defense objection was that the amount of force used to effectuate the battery must be reasonable and necessary under the circumstances. Now, that seems directly contrary with the legislative edict in NRS 200-160, which says deadly force is justified to prevent a felony. But here it says the deadly force must be reasonable and necessary under the circumstances, which, again, seems to be contrary to what the statute says. The district court relied on this Waddell decision, but in relying on Waddell, it forgot what had happened in Waddell, I think, with all due respect to the district court. In Waddell, there had been another section, a third section, that was part of NRS 200-160, which allowed the use of deadly force to prevent a fleeing felon. And the district court inquired of me specifically, said, Mr. Coffey, you know, how is this different? Well, it's different in that the harm has not been done. When somebody's going to perpetrate a felony on your person, the use of deadly force can prevent the felony. In a fleeing felon situation, it's something different. The person's trying to get away and the danger is over. So I think there's a clear distinction there. The other distinction that I think comes into play is with NRS 200-160, when the legislature specifically removed that third section concerning fleeing felons, it also adopted another section of the NRS that limited the use of deadly force in fleeing felon situations. Again, the legislature is clearly aware of what was going on in it, the other portions of NRS 200-160. They were aware of the common law, which allowed for the use of deadly force to prevent a felony from being committed on the person. And I know there's some talk in the briefs concerning, well, what about, well, for example, the use of narcotics? Could you use deadly force to prevent that? Or judicial bribery, for example, could you use deadly force to prevent that? But those aren't really what's covered by NRS 200-160, because 200-160 in both provisions talks about in doing something in defense of the slayer or in actual resistance to commit a felony upon the slayer. So the point is, what we're talking about is defending against felonies on the person in NRS 200-160, and that is what our position was at trial, is that we had a felony coercion upon the person of Mr. Newell, a demand by threat, which makes it a felony. And by the way, the coercion statute doesn't require a threat of serious or substantial bodily harm. The court also added that deadly force cannot be used unless the person battered poses a threat of serious bodily injury. That seems directly contrary to the very language of NRS 200-160, which says that what's required is a reasonable ground to apprehend a design on the part of the person slain to commit a felony or to commit some great personal injury. Effectively, the court limited us to arguing the second portion of that statute and eliminated the first portion of the statute, which is a reasonable ground to apprehend a design on the person slain to commit a felony.
Mr. Coffey, let me ask you this, because this is a really interesting case, and I was thinking about different scenarios about how this happened. Let's say in this situation, Mr. Newell, let's say he was carrying a gun with him, and he was approached by Mr. Bejarano after these incidents you described, and let's say he shot him and seriously injured him with the bullet and all like that. Is that any different than the cigarette lighter, do you think, or is it the same type of situation?
I believe it's the same type of situation, and I think that's one of the reasons the statute's drafted the way that it is the use of deadly force, and it doesn't distinguish between the sorts of deadly force that may be used. But effectively, by the court putting the shackles on us, they do distinguish among the sorts of deadly force that may be used. And it's a real difficult situation. You light somebody on fire. There is nothing more horrific than being thought about being lit on fire or being drowned, maybe attacked by a dog, you know, if you talk to a psychologist. But being lit on fire has a certain visceral feeling to it that gives us problems with the jury. But the way the statute's drafted, that's a hill we shouldn't have had to climb. The way the statute is drafted is the use of deadly force to prevent the commission of a felony, and I don't think it distinguishes among the sorts of deadly force. And it doesn't impose this reasonableness requirement. The way it's drafted, and at the common law, if they were going to commit a felony on your person, deadly force was reasonable.
So you're only disputing the portion of instruction number 37 that reads, the amount of force used to effectuate the battery must be reasonable and necessary under the circumstances.
And the next line, deadly force cannot be used unless the person battered poses a threat of serious bodily injury. Because that next line limits us only to the portion of NRS 200-160 after the commission of a felony, if that makes sense.
It does.
I have a question.
Yes.
And I apologize for the poor relay, so bear with me. But it's textual, and it has to do with 200-160 and your arguments. Is it your position that you agree that the felony must be one that is, and paragraph one of 200-160 is awkward, but to commit a felony to the slayer?
Well,
in paragraph one, there is no upon the person language, but you could say the clause after personal injury to the slayer, so it's commit a felony to the slayer. I mean, is there any limitation or is it any felony at all? The state's arguing that, you know, you see somebody about to, pass some kind of terrible theft type situation, bad paper, something that's fairly passive, doesn't put you in your peril for your person. Do you read that paragraph one to be limited to some sort of act on your person
felony? I think it is in defense of slayer. It couldn't be it's got to be a two-party sort of felony. It couldn't be, for example, you see somebody walking down the street smoking methamphetamine, so you pull out a gun and shoot the person. I think
yes, exactly. That's a better example.
Yeah, I don't think it can be that. I think it has to be a felony that is committed on or to the person. And I think that's what the language means in defense of slayer, although this is drafted some time ago. I think that's supported by the second portion also that talks about actual resistance of an attempt to commit a felony upon the slayer, which is subsection 2.
So subsection 2 is easier to follow. Subsection 1 is a bit awkward. But I see what you're saying. You would put the to the slayer or to any such person. You would say that also modifies to commit a felony to, but I'm not sure how you commit a felony to the slayer.
Well, a lot of situations might be self-defense, but I think this has to be distinguishable from self-defense. A situation might be exactly what we've got in this case. A felony to the slayer would be trying to coerce him in a felony way by threat or force to do something he has a right not to do, including, interestingly, the felony coercion statute includes a provision for depriving a person of any tool, implementation, clothing, or to hinder a person in the use thereof. I think that's one of the more interesting questions is, upon a slayer, does it include that portion of the coercion statute? I can see the arguments both ways. I don't think we have to rely on that portion of the coercion statute because I think there was reasonable grounds for Mr. Newell to think he was going to be injured or hurt if he didn't comply with what had been given. But I think it becomes more interesting when we talk about that little section of the coercion statute, if that would be upon a person, if you were depriving them of their use of their vehicle, for example, because one of the arguments made by the state at closing was just stay inside the Circle K. Let him do what he's going to do to your truck. Let him do whatever else. Just stay inside the Circle K when you call 911. And that seems to be contrary to a lot of history here in Nevada, right, wrong, or indifferent. Our legislatures allowed us to stand our ground for a number of years.
Mr. Coffey, you are well into your rebuttal time. I'm going to give you an extra minute. I'm going to give Mr. McDonald an extra minute as well.
Thank you.
Yes, of course.
May it please the Court, Justices, Counsel, good afternoon. First of all, I'd like to agree with this idea that, number one, 200.160 is not clear on its face, so then it needs some kind of interpretation, and I agree with that interpretation being that the felony enumerated in 160 needs to be some kind of felony on a person. I couldn't just see a person possessing counterfeit gold dust and shoot them in the head because it's a Category C felony. So I agree with that part, but moreover, I'm not interested in 200.160. I'm interested in the main justifiable homicide statutes, 200.120. And in 200.120, you do see an analog of what Judge Tao was trying to do when he added these qualifications to the justifiable battery jury instructions. And what he was trying to do is add a degree, basically a principle of proportionality. And I think that's essentially a distillation of what the defense objects to, is this idea that the response of the slayer to the actions of the victim have to be in proportion to the victim's actions. And in 200.120...
I have a question there, and perhaps you can enlighten me. If you credit your argument that you just made, the question I have is, what purpose does 200.160 sub, well, really both paragraphs, but especially subparagraph 1, serve in addition to what is covered by 120?
And I thought about that, and the answer is I'm not entirely sure. But reading them together, it looks like the difference that you find in 160 is it adds this defense of others component that's not clear in 120. So that would be my answer to your question, Justice Pickering.
Thank you.
Okay. So in 120, you see qualifications on the response. So it says justified homicide is the killing of a human being in necessary self-defense. So there's your necessary that we saw in the jury's instruction. To prevent a violent felony. So it does qualify the kind of felony. It has to be a violent felony. The next provision, 200.130, adds further qualifications to the amount of fear that the slayer has to have based on the actions of the victim. They cannot be a bare fear. It has to be additionally objectively reasonable. So then in these statutes, we have the necessary and the reasonable that we find in Judge Tao's jury instructions. And of course, the justified battery statute tracks directly back to the justified homicide statute. So
I'm having trouble with that, Mr. McDonald, because I think that the justifiable battery definition contains the language when it says justifiable battery is the battery of a human being when there is a reasonable ground to apprehend a design on the part of the person better to commit a felony, and there is imminent danger of such design being accomplished. I don't know why we need any more, because I think the reasonable and necessary that the appellant complains of is contained in just precisely the definition of justifiable battery. So I'm not sure why the judge felt the need to go further.
Because I think we have like different justifiable battery and justifiable homicide and self-defense and what's the other one? Resistance by party about to be injured. We have different statutory provisions. So I think the statutory scheme is a little scattered because there is 200.275, which is also the justifiable battery statute that says any circumstances that constitute justifiable homicide. And that's why it tracks back to the justifiable homicide, and that's why I started my discussion at least with that provision, because that's the direction I think the district court took.
Mr. McDonald, let me ask you this. From your standpoint, in interpreting all these statutes, what type of defense mechanisms could Mr. Newell have used based upon this scenario as alleged by Mr. Coffey, of this harassment and things happened over this period of time? What could he have done that would have been permissible Obviously, no, other than lighting a pouring gasoline on and lighting a cigarette lighter. No.
Honestly, I don't know. I think Mr. Coffey did as best he could, and he did an excellent job under the circumstances, given the facts of these cases. Because he did get, even though there was this qualification to the justifiable homicide component, he still got the jury instructed on the elements of coercion. And he may have misspoke, but he said that he wasn't allowed to argue about coercion. But if you read his closing, it's all about the coercion and the elements of coercion and tracking that as the felony that justified the actions. But the proportionality component he was stuck with, because I believe that's the law, and it also should be the law, because that's, I think,
well, the thing what I was thinking about is trying to write a rule on this, as you can appreciate formally working here and all and doing this, is that what if this was a small woman was in play, instead of Mr. Nolan, I don't know how tall or big Mr. Bejarano is, but say he's a big man. Now, a woman might be terrified by this type of conduct if it's true. What could that woman have done under the circumstances here if you're harassed and all like that, just trying to put gas in your car?
For instance, could she shoot?
Could she shoot, or because you have maybe the size enter into it? Is it something, is gender enter into it? Things like this that when we're trying to craft a rule here, asking us to interpret these statutes, if we're going to do that, we don't want to create a lot of ambiguities and all with it. We're trying to be as clear as possible. How would you approach it then?
I'm not sure that we need to approach it any differently than this proportionality concept and the necessary and reasonable response, because when you're looking at the objectively reasonable kind of analysis for the response, I think it would incorporate all of these things. She pepper sprayed him. I would think that's clearly reasonable, okay? I mean, it's unclear. Of course, the defendant has his own story. The victim doesn't really remember anything. But in his statement to police, he said the most of it was he was saying, hey, homie, can I get a ride? Can I get a ride, homie? You're going to give me a ride, homie, right? It certainly doesn't rise to setting him on fire. It certainly, like Mr. Coffey said, he did push him at one point. That's an appropriate response. He was in the 7-Eleven, or Circle K, did it too. Why didn't he stay there? You know, those components all go into the analysis, and I think
I would certainly feel concerned to the level of felony coercion if someone at a gas station told me that I was going to take him home. And I'm not sure that the gender or the size makes a difference. But I'll tell you, I think that we have to be mindful of that, as Justice Gibbons points out. Because if someone said, even if they just kept saying, home girl or whatever I would be, you're taking me home, I would absolutely be fearful to the extent of a felony coercion.
Well, the jury was instructed on felony coercion, and the jury considered coercion. I mean, this case was a coercion case, essentially. So the jury had all of that information. We're talking about an error in the instruction that may have led them astray. They weren't led astray, so whatever they decided based on the facts and circumstances of the case, was it necessary, was it reasonable, I think that's what we're left with.
But under this instruction, I would not be, as written, it would not have been reasonable. I could not have defended myself under these circumstances on the fact that this commentary, this being cornered and being told that I'm going to take somebody home, would not have been adequate for me to find it justifiable. I think there's a problem with that.
Well, I don't think that changes the instruction. I think that changes the defense. And so, you know, if you shot him in the head and killed him and you're here on a murder trial, then your lawyer would say, look at this defendant. He's 5'8", yes, but he's like 300 pounds, and here's his picture, and here's his, you know, perhaps his criminal history or something like that, and here's the menacing situation. And jury, look at my client, you know? She had a reason. Her response was reasonable under these circumstances. And this defendant's response was not reasonable, the jury found, under these circumstances. Should I move on to the...
Yes, thank you.
Okay. So I want to talk about the attempt assault. I assume Mr. Coffey is probably going to address that in his rebuttal time. So the claim is that you cannot attempt an assault. So for this, we have to kind of break down the assault statute. And the jury was not given the first subsection of the assault statute, which is the attempt battery. They were given the reasonable apprehension of imminent bodily harm provision. So that's what they were presented with. And if you break that statutory provision down, it is intentionally placing the victim in apprehension. So the intent goes to the apprehension. That's what an assault defendant is trying to do, is create a state of apprehension of imminent bodily harm in the victim.
I just wondered, though, Mr. McDonald, don't you either commit an assault or you don't? I mean, this kind of, I always thought attempt assault was one of those fictitious pleas people would enter into in plea bargains and all, and they really didn't exist, you know, but you're saying it does exist, you know, like that. But tell me again, what's the difference between an attempt assault and an actual assault? Assault's a threat or something.
A threat.
Point a gun at you or point a finger or something threatening, menacing. What's that between attempting? How do you draw the distinction between the two?
Because he tries and he fails.
He tries.
He intends to do it. He does do it.
Yeah.
But he fails.
But the assault is the actual just threatening. You know, it seems to me you do it or you don't do it.
Well, the assault is the state of apprehension in the victim.
Right.
So that's why it failed in this case, because either the victim was too drunk, or he had just been set on fire and so he was busy screaming, or he had some kind of retrograde amnesia because he was placed in a medically induced coma for 2 weeks. So essentially he doesn't remember. He didn't testify that he remembered anything about it, but it was on video, and the other eyewitnesses testified that they saw the thing and they heard what he said, threatening to remove his member, etc. So it's clear that it happened. Victim didn't testify to it, so that's why it was pled as an attempt, because we cannot show that it succeeded because the defendant can't testify that he was in that state of apprehension.
Okay.
So I just want to, we filed a supplemental authorities on this assault, the attempt assault issue. We did some research from all jurisdictions, and of the, I think, between 14 and 18 jurisdictions that actually in their assault statutes have this reasonable apprehension or some variant thereof, only one of those jurisdictions found that you cannot have an attempt assault, and that's Georgia.
So the two cases you did, one's Louisiana, one's Minnesota, you think they're analogous enough to our statutory human case law for us to consider as persuasive authority?
Yes. The case law, yes. The fact pattern is highly unique. And I wasn't able to find any kind of, like, victims in comas that were, you know, that kind of thing, or the blind victim, you know, what Judge Tao was trying to analogize to. So this case factually is very unique. But as far as the law goes, I think those are persuasive. And we did have one case, and that was actually in our brief, and it's a Washington appellate case named State v. Music. And I just wanted to, they had a very succinct kind of line in their case that I just wanted to read. There is no logical conflict in charging one with attempting to put another in apprehension of harm. I'd invite further questions. Other than that, I'll submit.
Ms. Pickering, any questions?
None that I haven't asked.
Thank you very much, Mr. McDonald. Mr. Coffey.
Just briefly, the case from Georgia that he's talking about is the Patterson case. Their statute tracks ours. In Patterson, the victim was asleep. And that's probably factually about as the closest analogy to what we have here, is where Mr. Braha doesn't really know if he's threatened or not. Mr. Newell actually said he was trying to hold him for a citizen's arrest. That gives you some idea of his state of mind in this whole thing, and said as much in a statement to the police afterwards. The wherewithal or the physical ability of Mr. Newell to defend is kind of interesting, because there's a decent chance in this case he was targeted by Mr. Brano. There was a handicap placard hanging from his rearview mirror. The jury was aware of that. He is an elderly gentleman. I say elderly. His health wasn't the best. He's over 60. That doesn't look elderly to me anymore, but at one point it certainly seemed elderly. Mr. Brunner was a man in his 30s, good physical condition. He worked as a stagehand in Las Vegas, just by way of background as to whether or not it was a coercive situation. I don't think there's much question that it was coercive. The problem is not that we weren't given instructions on coercion. It's the shackles that were placed on us by this reasonable amount of force. Must be reasonable and necessary under the circumstances, and it must be a threat of serious bodily injury. So, I mean, under that theory, you know, if the jury thinks that Brano's just going to give Mr. Newell a sock in the mouth if he doesn't give him a ride, that's not serious bodily injury, and he can't protect himself. That doesn't seem to be what the legislature was trying to do when they drafted 200-160. I think Justice Pickering had a very good point about 160 and whether or not if we adopt the state's position, this would be essentially meaningless. I don't know what 160 means if we adopt the state's position. I don't know how it's that different than a self-defense situation, which is really what NRS 200-120 goes to. This is about felonies, and if I can't couch the person who's injured's actions in terms of a felony, then I don't get the protections of the statute. But in this case, I thought we were able to do it. Facts were able to do it, and the instructions that were given by the court prevented the jury from seriously considering that, the additions that we were shackled with. So, with that, it's submitted.
Thank you, Mr. Coffey. Thank you, Mr. McDonald. This matter will stand submitted, and the court will now be